They say falling snowflakes are the tears of the snow princess. Are you the one she's waiting for?
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. So I think before we launch into our discussion of Shirahime Sho, we should do a little end of the year check-in.
Yeah, I like that. That sounds good.
We're almost at the end of 2019 as of recording this.
Yeah.
And that's super terrifying. And I'm not excited about the next year being 2020. I mean, like, I guess I'm not excited about it, but it feels like every year has gone by so fast for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited to get to 2020, but I'm also a little apprehensive about...
Is that number just sort of exciting?
You know, that number means we get a new presidency.
And... Oh my god, no, definitely. No, there's a lot of, like, look, there are lots of things to look forward to about next year.
I'm very afraid as well, though, very afraid. Oh my
god, I know.
But I don't want to think too hard about that. We are here to think about fun things.
Good things.
Clamp.
This is your finals week. You're almost done.
It is. I had one final yesterday, one final the day before that, and then one final tomorrow. So...
Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah, it's going well. I'm excited. I'm applying to a grad program.
Again. Lucy has a master's, guys.
I do.
Lucy has a master's. Lucy may be getting another master's?
Yeah, currently Lucy's
Is this an MFA?
Yes. Yeah, my previous degree was in book publishing under writing, and then this would be creative writing, but hopefully also working as a graduate assistant teaching writing classes, because I want to use the MFA well, to improve my writing, but also to get writing jobs out, to, like, teaching writing afterwards.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, look, everyone can always improve their writing.
Yeah.
Like, that is just one of those, like, nobody can't use a little bit of that, but.
Yeah, I don't hate the idea of 2 years spent just focusing on my writing and focused on teaching writing, which is the thing I think I might want to do. So, it's, if I get into it and everything goes well, it.
You're a good teacher and you're really patient, too. Aww. So I think that, like, I'm excited. And I think that especially because you'd be teaching at a college level.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to teach, like, kids. No offense to kids, but...
It's a completely different thing.
Yes.
Like, you're teaching a different level of writing and you're teaching people what writing is as opposed to teaching people how to be better writers. And that is wildly different.
Yeah.
I am at page 167 out of 225 of my big graphic novel. I might be a little past that, because depending on the numbers of my pages in my InDesign document where I'm lettering and compiling everything, there it says I'm already at, like, page 168, 169. The original thumbnails I'm working off of think I'm on page 172, but the file itself says I'm on page, like, 167. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, so that means that I'm ahead of where I should be in terms of the thumbnails, because I've cut a lot of pages out and, like, consolidated things, but in my InDesign file, I'm only a little bit ahead, which means I've added pages, which I defo did.
Okay. I didn't realize you did that in InDesign. That's really interesting.
Yeah, oh my goodness. Lucy taught me InDesign?
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I forgot I did that.
Yeah, you taught me InDesign however many years ago, like when you were still in the publishing program.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it has been like, I'm not an InDesign wizard, but I can do text layout in InDesign, and do you know what makes your life so much easier?
I'm sure that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, you remember this because I taught you how to set up like paragraph styles. And
yeah,
stuff,
which is
so good.
Most of what I'm doing right now, because it's literally just I'm putting an image in and then I'm placing text. Mm-hmm. But all of the dialogue and all of the narration text are in, they have different paragraph styles on top of them. And it means that if at some point my publisher is like, ooh, we really want it to be a slightly smaller text size, I can do that in a single click. Whereas if I were doing this in Illustrator or Photoshop, I'd have to go through multiple files.
Yeah.
And I can do it instantly for this.
Yeah, I hate doing text in Photoshop. I have to do it for our graphics, but I could not. Choose to.
Yeah. And there's definitely, like, there are things I know how to do to text in Photoshop. It just in terms of, like, building the image of the text in Photoshop, I don't know how to do in InDesign. But anything having to do with actual text layout, and oh my god, thank you, InDesign, for existing. My mind is a little bit on some of these technical aspects of making comics right now, because it came up a lot in our research for Shidahime's show.
Yeah, which I'm very excited about, because it came up in my research also, but I did not understand it until you described it to me.
Yeah, no, like, it's really exciting for me to look at this period of Clamp, because I do not work on comics in the same, like, methods that they used to use. I work super digitally, and all of publishing has moved on to a very digital standard, and it's been there for, at this point, decades, but not three decades. Like, we're talking about 30 years ago, where so much was still done by hand. There was still, like, color separations and tone separations. Oh my god. So we're going to get into some of that, which is really cool, because they... Clamp actually do talk a bit about the technical side of their work. I have art books. This is not stargazing. Okay. Look at me and tell me it's not stargazing. Okay. I have art books from some other later work that were really important to me and my little brother, who's also a comic artist, growing up. Like, we read these books a lot, and they had some tutorials in the back, and most of that was stuff that I could not quite use. Mm. Like, it just never clicked for me, because they were big early adopters of Copic markers, and they used them in ways that... And I still use Copic markers in design work all the time, but I don't use it quite the way they do. They also had a... they used a lot of airbrushing in that era. I mean, I get that effect in Photoshop, but I don't. I've never used a real airbrush.
Yeah, I am tempted. As a... I don't know... new anime manga fan back in middle school, trying to, like, replicate techniques and stuff. Like, yeah. I even bought a bunch of the toner paper and was trying to, like, cut it out and paste it on.
Do you still have that?
Probably somewhere if you can in find my parents'
it,
house.
If you can find it, my brother uses toner paper sometimes now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I will look.
Also, maybe I'll steal it because he says I should try it out because yeah. It's crazy.
It is crazy. I have so much respect for how people actually make it work. Like, I was never able to utilize it. I also realized quickly how expensive that would be.
It is really expensive.
Yeah.
Every single tool that goes into making manga is really expensive. Every single one of them, and they're really specific, and some of them you do need to use the exact tools because of how they reproduce the pages, or used to, because you had photocopying and everything. Like, there was a specific pipeline, so you had to use a lot of the same material, or else you would be making life hell for people in print production. And by the way, I have friends who work in print production, and they say that artists still make their lives hell with digital art.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I mean, like, I'm so sorry, and we can all learn to do better, but also... it's kind of how it is. Like, if you make everything to be just to be easiest to reproduce, then you're not using the full breadth of everything you can do as an artist, and that seems like a shame, too. Sorry?
I mean, it's just different sides of the art, really. Like,
yeah.
There's the art of trying to reproduce that in printing, and then the art of initially creating it, and it's all fascinating.
And it's all a pain in the ass. But looking through those old Clamp books, like, they did used to tell you a lot about how they made their work, and I remember there were a few techniques that they taught me that I did use, and I, one of those comes up in this, and I'm gonna bring it up at some point.
That's exciting.
I really respect how much they like to talk about the technical side of what they do, because, I mean, their work is technically very interesting and very proficient, and this book is so different from anything else we've ever seen of theirs, kind of with the exception of Xun Huang, and as we mentioned in the last episode, that's partially because this happened first. We did things slightly out of order. We're sorry, but not that sorry, because who cares?
this was more thematic for our winter season. I'm okay with
it. Yeah. Fair, right? So this came up first. 1992, and I think it was it like April or May of... I'm going to say April or May of 1992.
I think it was June.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah,
I'm dumb.
Yeah, because I remember feeling like it was so summery, whereas whenever it came out in America, they specifically were like... we're putting it out in December and January. It just felt like they were going way more with the season with the American publications. That's the only reason the other date kind of jumped out at me. I think it was June.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting things about the publication history of this, but I think maybe we should talk a little bit about the title and what it is.
Yeah, probably. So, Shidahime Sho is basically just a collection of three little short stories with a bookend. As in a little opening and a little ending
section. Like a prologue and an epilogue.
Yeah. And they're basically just kind of surrounding this concept of snowflakes being the tears of the snow goddess. And there's a lot of kind of like themes of isolationism and like
just loss. Isolation, not isolationism.
Sorry, not isolationism. This is isolation.
This is a fairly apolitical book.
Yes. No. Also the literal you are stuck in a snowstorm type of Well, and a little bit of the like left behind and
yes.
It's very fairy tale. It's very kind of dreamlike.
Yeah.
It's very kind of pulling on old legends and feels like old legends.
Yeah, each of the stories is definitely set in an indefinite historical period, but separate ones. And they say that was on purpose, that, like, each of the stories, they didn't set them in a very specific time period because they did not have time to do the research that they would like to do if they were going to have historical costuming, which they did for Shun Hong, right? But for this, they did not have time. And so they were just like, okay, this is going to feel like one era, this is going to feel kind of like another. They wanted to have the feeling of these stories being across time, but not necessarily specifically tied to anything, which I think really fits that sense of folklore time, mythological time, right?
Yeah. And they all kind of deal with loss in some way or another, or sacrifice. I think I'm going to really briefly just go over the plot lines, because we're going to have a lot to say in this episode, but it's not going to be a whole lot about the story, because the story is not as, I guess, complex as a lot of their other work.
Yeah, the production of it is sort of, like, more interesting. The presentation and the production are way more where the effort went into, like, not effort, but where there's more to say about that. The stories are, they stand on their own really well, and yeah, like, go ahead, take it away.
Like, it's not incomplex in like a negative way, but
no.
So the prologue and the epilogue kind of is this scene of a man on a mountain. He encounters a beautiful woman. He's concerned why she's out, you know, in the snowstorm, and she says she's waiting for someone, and he kind of warns her, like, oh, it's dangerous to be out here. Oh, this kind of snow is when the goddess is crying, and she kind of just looks at him.
Yeah, with her like piercingly meaningful glance, and I am definitely very in love with her.
She's beautiful.
If we have time, I can go on for a long time about how much I love her and characters like her, as weird as that is. But I will not interrupt anymore. Yeah. What's our next story?
So the first story is called On Wolf Mountain, and it's about this girl named Fubuki, she's seeking revenge. Her father was killed, assumably by this wolf that's kind of very dark and has red eyes and very ominous, and man, killer wolf and everything. So she goes to kill the wolf, take revenge, ends up getting attacked by wild dogs, and is instead kind of saved by this wolf who kind of drags her into a cave and even like brings her food. And she's very torn. She's like, I feel like I should kill it because it killed my father, but it's helping me. Maybe it didn't kill my father. Maybe that's wrong. It's so gentle to me.
She definitely has that moment when the two of them are out, like, she heals from the wounds that she was given by those wild dogs, and, like, they go out kind of, like, hunting and stuff together. Like, they have this bond.
Yeah.
And at some point the wild dogs show up again and stuff like that, and she has this moment where she's like, wow, was it really you who killed my father, or was it these wild dogs? Did we have this wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she befriends this wolf and is kind of out playing, running around with him.
She names him, too.
Oh, yeah. She names him Inuki, which goes with Fubuki, which we're going to mention that and say to remember that, and we're going to come back to that in a different episode.
Yeah.
Yay.
Wolves named Inuki maybe have a clamp significance.
They may indeed.
Who knows?
So while she and Inuki are off, you know, kind of frolicking through the snow, it turns out that her mother has also followed her and shoots the wolf to avenge her fallen husband, and, you know, kind of chastises her and tells her that this wolf killed your father, how could you do this? And it kind of is implied that maybe the wolf took care of her. Well, I think her mom literally suggests this, that the wolf took care of her because it knew that this was the daughter of the man it had killed. And so it has that sort of, like, wolf spirit feel to it. It's very sweet.
Yeah. Was this the wolf respecting, you know, respecting the death that it had caused, and, like, maybe even having something like guilt or responsibility towards her? Or was it, as the mother suggested, at any moment going to turn on her?
Yeah.
And that interesting, the sort of, like, how humans can't always understand nature, and we anthropomorphize but sometimes we fail to anthropomorphize, and that's a problem too, where if you don't see, like, you can assume the worst of nature just as much as you can assume that they're acting under human motivations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder whether this story harkens to their interest in the Hakenden? Because as you know, they had their own version of that, which by this point probably had already been abandoned. I think that thing was like 89. Like, I think that already...
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it was pretty early. That was an early thing for them to, you know, barely even launch. But, I mean, in Hakenden, somebody definitely has a wolf lover, and, I mean, lover may be a bad way of describing it. They do have a whole lot of dog babies.
Yeah, the I think in that... I don't remember... In their version, if we know, but I think in their version it was one lady had a bunch of dog babies to different dog wolf spirits.
Oh, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
But anyway, it's probably a callback to that a bit. And they do, we've seen, like, the dog, there was, like, a dog spirit or something in one of the Tokyo Babylon things.
Yeah.
Like, we've seen them kind of have this, like, I don't know, fondness for wolfy dogs.
And of course in, you know, like, all of human folklore has so much to say about our connection with dogs and wolves, because about as long as we have been human beings, dogs have been a part of our lives, and that's very... I do think it's a really interesting thing to do with a folklore piece, especially this one has a fairly ancient... Like, this one is an older look. Like, they're not wearing very sophisticated clothing. It looks like pre-Heian and maybe maybe very much so.
Just have bows and arrows. There's no guns or anything to speak of. The second story is called The Ice Flower, and this is about a man who has to leave, I kind of assumed, for war.
But they say for war.
Do they say for war? Okay. Yeah. When I was flipping back through it, I kind of missed
I'm almost
that,
certain.
I was like, I just assumed for war, so.
Yeah, I mean, I may be remembering the next one.
Yeah,
I
think it's an easy assumption, even if they don't outright say it, but
yeah.
He has to leave, and he's leaving behind his woman, like,
his girlfriend, his
something,
fiance,
whatever it is, and he feels bad leaving her alone in this small village, and they're saying goodbye at this lake that, legend has it, is so cold that it's freezing even in spring, and if you go swimming in it, you will freeze even in spring. It is always cold, like, this is an area that is just never, never warm.
I'm getting a Hokkaido feel from this, because it's gotta be in the north, right?
Yes. So, they're having a very, like, tearful goodbye, and she kind of says, I'll wait for you here forever, unchanging, until you return.
Yeah, her speech, like, her goodbye, but I will always be waiting for you speech, is, like, a large chunk of this story. Like, I'd say almost maybe the majority of the pages of this are this goodbye that she gives him that is so, like... It's such a big commitment that she is making to wait for him.
Yeah. And then it, you know, kind of jumps to 30 years later where he's returning. He's an old man. He doesn't know if she'll be waiting for him anymore. He kind of assumes she won't because it's been 30 years. But
I will also say, by old man, he must mean 50s.
Yeah, he must be in his 50s.
Because they said it was 30 years.
Yeah.
And 30 years is a long time to leave your village and never return. But like, how old are either of these people in the beginning?
Yeah. Well, they're depicting him as very old, but... I mean, it might also possibly be that he's just trudged through the snow for however long and is kind of beat
down.
He's worn down. But anyway, much older anyway, he returns and, you know, when he gets to the lake, there's no one there. And he's like, yes, how could I expect her to be waiting? And he kind of has a sad but not, you know, surprised reaction. And then he looks down into the lake and realizes that she's there frozen in the ice like he left her.
I mean, she had a whole speech about waiting like a beautiful flower and there she is.
Yeah.
Dead chick, ice flower, same thing.
Yeah, yeah. And she did say unchanged until you get back.
And you're like,
frozen.
Yeah. There's one way that's gonna go.
Yeah. And it doesn't have any, like, I'm gonna try to unfreeze my dead wife or anything, so I don't know if magically she would be okay, but I don't suspect not.
It does not come up. Does not have to say anything about what happens next.
Mm-hmm. And so the third story is Hyoku no Tori, which I looked up, and it's literally like bird wings, but it's a phrase that means happily married couple.
Yeah,
which is cute.
Like wings are like a pair.
Like a pair of wings. I think is another like semi literal translation of it. And so this one is about a soldier who's lost in the forest, and he's kind of remembering back to his wife, girlfriend, lover, Yukino, who kind of begged him not to go and kind of chastised him for being so obsessed with war and killing when he could just be here with her. And so he's kind of just wandering around feeling, I mean, he's lost and has been wandering for a while. He got separated from the other soldiers and he sees this pair of herons and he's so angry that two birds could be together when he can't be with the one he loves that he just in frustration just shoots one of the herons and then just, you know, leaves. And a couple days later, as he's just been wandering in circles, he comes back and finds the corpse of the bird that died, but it's missing a head. And
ominous, which is also terrible because it means he's been going around in circles. Yeah. And he is not excited to know about that.
And possibly means that there are wild dogs that ate part of the heron that can now come and eat him. So he's bad time. And I think he around then starts to succumb to the snow. And then he has this vision of this beautiful woman. And he thinks, oh, maybe this is, you know, a death god or, you know, some sort of ghost that has visited me or something. Maybe she's pointing to my death because she kind of gestures off into the distance. And he notices that she's holding like a human skull that looks semi-decaying or whatever. Like it's very skull-like.
Desiccated.
Like desiccated, yeah. And he's like, oh, that's creepy. And then he wakes up and kind of has the will to continue on. So he decides to follow where she was pointing because he needs a direction to go in. And maybe it will be to his death or maybe it will be to the village.
Yeah, but he might as well go there since he has no idea how else, you know, where else to go.
Yeah.
You had a vision, you might as well follow it. You're going to die anyway, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So he's going along and he's like, yes, I can keep doing this. I'm just going to, you know, shoot anything that moves so I can get food and I will survive. And he sees movement, so he shoots at something. Discovers it's a heron, and when he picks it up, a little heron skull falls out of its wings, and so it was carrying the head of its dead heron from earlier, and he kind of realizes, oh, that lady I saw was probably this heron. Oh god, you helped me even though I killed your mate, and now you! But sure enough, as he looks up, he can see the foot of the hill with, like, a village in it behind, or below them, and so she got him there.
Yay!
Yay! And it's very sad, and yeah. And so that's the third of the really proper stories, and then we get a little epilogue where we return to the man and the woman from the beginning, where a bunch of kind of dog spirits or wolf spirits appear and join the woman, and she kind of reveals that she's the snow goddess and says, those tears aren't me crying, those are the tears of mankind, the despair of man, and she kind of just swooshes away.
Yeah, I think each one of the stories mentioned the snowflakes or the tears of the snow princess.
They each kind of worked it in somewhere.
Often in places that were not easy to fit into the summaries.
Yeah.
Which is why we didn't very well. But
it was usually things that either someone thought or kind of got mentioned towards the end of the story as things just sort of wound around, but weren't really part of the actual plot of the story. They were just kind of like symbols each of them kind of used to describe the snow. Yeah, and that's pretty much it. It's not a very, like we said, it's not a very complex, like, plot line, but they all kind of like, it's very atmospheric, and it feels very like you were kind of reading a painting.
Yeah, it definitely feels like you're reading a painting, and in so many ways, because of course they are painted.
Mm-hmm.
They were all done in ink in a way that is definitely supposed to evoke historical paintings and traditional Japanese, you know, sumi paints, sumi inking, but also like very much fits with the folktale feel that they all have. Some of these elements are things that do come up in folktales, but all of them are original to Clamp. None of these are an actual folktale retelling. They say that they were very influenced by, I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Manga legends, I think?
Yeah. Like
manga Japanese legends.
Yeah.
A TV special?
Yeah. That would have had some sort, probably a Yuki Onna story or something like that, that got them really excited. And it's also, they say it's very influenced by Phoenix by Osamu Tezuka, which it definitely is, but in ways that are very, it's very odd because that's like, you know, it's almost weird to say that.
It's like an abstract inspiration.
Yeah.
Because
it like,
direct.
Yeah, Phoenix, it's one of the most, it's like an intensely detailed, incredibly long, he never finished it. He died before he could finish it, but it is a super masterpiece and it is an incredible read. But what it has in common is that it is over many different historical periods, and then has recurring themes, and then the character who is sort of set aside from everything is sort of an observer, but also inextricably linked to all the stories, like the Phoenix and that, and Shirahime in this. Mm-hmm. And I love characters like that.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, like, other examples of things like this that, like, are pretty modern. The druggist from Mononoke is a great example of a character who is very much like, now that character is a little more involved in those stories, but they're still sort of like, this character is the framework for an episodic thing, and that themes develop through that. Pet Shop of Horrors, Count D is kind of the character like that too. Again, way more influential on the plot, but still is almost, you know, like, more of the framework than a main character. And for various reasons, I just love those characters. I just love them. They're always the best. They get to be sort of mysterious and sort of set apart from everything. And Clamp will come back to those characters a few times in other things.
That's a type that they do like.
But it's also interesting, but it's also interesting that they do come back to that, partially because they say they were influenced by Osamu Tezuka in terms of having, like, he called it his star system, right? Idea that all of his characters are just cast members that could be cast in any story, and then sometimes that is commentary and it reinterprets a character, and sometimes it's literally just so that he doesn't have to come up with a new character design. And how, like, for a comic artist who's trying to produce a lot of work very quickly, it is very helpful to have those stock characters. Like, that's great. This is not laziness. This is what enables you to produce incredible amounts of work really quickly, because all the effort can go into the writing, into the storytelling, and not just into intricate character designs. But I love that Clamp have many times said that they also view their characters that way. They think of it, like, we talk about there being a Clampverse, and there's many reasons to think about them as sort of, like, having that in their own minds a little bit, too. But also the idea that these characters are, again, they're cast members, like, they could be cast in anything. And Shirahime had existed previous to this. I don't think that she was actually in any doujinshi. They say that she had appeared in some promotional artwork that they had put in various things, and they sort of knew how they wanted to use her. They knew that she was going to be used, like, in some sort of folklore-feeling comic, but they didn't quite know what it was going to be.
Yeah, they think they said that she appeared in their magazine.
Yeah.
So I think, like, she didn't have her own doujinshi, but she may have appeared alongside.
Well, and they said literally it was like a promo postcard that was included in that. So, like, they knew that this character existed. Her character design existed, and her character design is so beautiful and elegant. Like, complicated white kimono, often wearing kind of a veil piece with, I mean, oh my god, just absolutely beautiful. So, in 1992, they were asked to pitch for a comic for a magazine that told them they were folding within a couple months. And this is Baru Pretty. I don't know if it's Vol or Bar Pretty. I have seen it both ways, but it's Baru. I mean, let's just say it, right? And they were approached to do this comic, and they said, sure, and they had 10 days to do it. And Shirahime existed previously, but they had no idea what they were doing, and they figured it out, and they produced this in 10 days.
Just madness.
That is madness. I don't know how many pages it is precisely. It's not that many. Like, it is pretty short, and there is a lot of glorious, wonderful white space in this. But the fact that it is done in brush inks and the fact that it was done in 10 days are extremely related facts. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about that, because they said that on the one hand, yes, that was an insane deadline, and they knew it was an insane deadline, but it was also really fun because it meant that it was really unified and they could focus just on that. And how they wish that they would ever have a chance to do that. And it breaks my heart, but is also very relatable, because I'm not sure I have ever in my adult career had a month where I could focus on specifically one project. And I'm about to cry thinking about how much I want that. I'm like, oh no, I get it. Like, it's weird how you always need to take on so much work in order to stay afloat. But also, how do you turn something down when you remember what it was like when you weren't a professional at all? And so you're always doing more work. Also, usually not any single one thing you're doing pays you enough to only do one thing. That's another problem, too. And with these things, I mean, like, I have no idea how much money they've ever made off of Shirahime. I have no idea. But considering that it is just a couple chapters, it's not that many pages, probably not a whole lot. But they made it anyway. And they made it in this very specific way because using brush inks, working in that way, is a technical skill that you have to have. But once you have it, it goes quickly. There's no outlining these really, you know, complex spaces and then having somebody else fill it in with black. it's you and the brush, and you get one chance to do that, and you can tweak, and you can clean it up a little bit, but they say that they really did not have time to clean up. Like, they had to sit down and just make this art. They also did not use ideal paper for this. They said that every page was soaked through from all of the water that they used in not just the black, but also the gray tones are all done in ink wash.
Yeah, the pages must have been, like, because, I mean, I've done stuff like that when I was playing with brushes and stuff, and I can't imagine the pages didn't get so warped from it.
Yeah.
But they don't look like, not in a way that it impacted it negatively, yeah. At least, so that's impressive.
Yeah. In these days before Photoshop and digital compositing, a lot of the work that they had been doing would have been, like, if you didn't like how a face turned out, you could use a lot of white out and paint over that, which is, you know, not paint over that, but ink over that. That's fine, but you can also ink on a separate piece of paper or on tracing paper and tape and glue things over it. And as long as it gets through the photocopier, fine. No one ever has to see how messy your page looked. But, I mean, like, doing that by hand! Oh, yeah. I mean, I can do that in Photoshop, and I can clean up everything, and it's fine. You'll never know that I had to redraw that head 50 times. But they couldn't do that for this. They had to just sit down, like, they couldn't even have one person draw a background and one person draw a character. It kind of all had to be continuously done in one go. And so I'm almost certain they used non-photo blue pencil to pencil in things. Like, it's precise enough that I'm sure they did that. It does not have the looseness of being straight in ink, but it is loose. And their work tends to be very precise and technical. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very clean lines. Lots and lots of little tedious details that make your hand fall off to think about inking. And that is not present in this. There is detail.
Yeah, it's not loose in, like, a messy way.
Yeah.
But it definitely has, like, a different flow to it than
yeah. Usual. Yeah, there's a lot more line width. And the lines themselves are clearly an ink brush. There's some dry brush going on there. Like, there's a lot of texture. And the backgrounds do not have that technical precision. They are loose, they're a little bit more impressionistic, not so much so to tell you that this is I would not look at this and say, oh, this is the way they should do everything, because they don't have that technical proficiency in ink that says, oh, they're really ink painters at heart.
Yeah.
Like, this is, it looks fantastic, yeah. But it does not look like, oh, this is what they should always have been doing.
Yeah, because it really adds to this specific project's, like, atmosphere and kind of dreamlike legend quality, but I agree, like, it's not a thing that would work for everything, but they used it very well.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
And I think you earlier, when I was being confused about things, pointed out, like, how Japanese people get way more practice with brush tips than we do.
Yeah, well, if you're learning any kind of traditional calligraphy, which is really common, because to write kanji properly, you should be using a brush, because it's intended to be done that way. And if you are not using a brush, there's, you know, like, the stroke order for kanji has to do with where you put your brush down and where you're getting those little flips from picking up and putting down your brush. So there's a little bit of, like, if you are trained in that, the idea of using this very, like, brushes are wild. They have their own ideas about what to do, but if you are used to handling them, it's not as terrifying, and it means you can go really quickly. I know a lot of comic artists who love to use brush inks, and they're like, wow, it goes so much faster, because so much more, there's just so much more pigment on the page, so much faster.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not a thin little line that means you have to spend forever to get any amount of, like, not only just takes longer to move it across the page, but also takes longer to get it precise, and also takes longer to build up more, more black. But the minute you've got a big old delicious brush just full of ink, it definitely goes way quickly, but that could be terrifying if it goes in the wrong direction and you didn't handle it right.
Yeah, it reminds me a little of like, writing in cursive versus print.
Yeah.
Where, like, it takes you a little bit to learn it, and many of us at this point don't learn it or have forgotten it, but once you can write in it, it makes your writing much faster, which is why it was used to be the standard for, like, handwritten essays and stuff.
Yeah, not picking your hand up off the paper means less wasted time moving your hand around, and it's kind of similar to how it works with brushes. They also did not use toner for this, which we've already mentioned. They used ink wash, which is beautiful. So it means you have this perfect gradation of gray all over the place. And because this is about snow, and they achieve snow, it looks cold. There's a lot of white on the page, which is also a very genius thing to do if you know you have 10 days to complete a comic project with many, many pages. The less your brush hits the paper, the less time you're spending drawing. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of design skill to plan for that. But oh my goodness, if you can do that, it will make it go faster because you just don't have to do as much on each page. So that was genius. But the ink wash also is just beautiful in this. And they said that that created one of the biggest problems, that the hardest part of this was getting that to reproduce properly, because this is before, again, this is before digital print production. So people were doing that by hand. And I don't completely understand the process for half toning. It is related to the photo process you use for silk screening, where you are exposing fabric and plates to light and chemicals in order to, like, get a certain density of little dots so that you can reproduce that gray. And they said that they had to, like, oversee that process, but it was multiple print technicians, so some of the print technicians could do what they were asking really easily, and some of them didn't get back to them in time, so not every page looks perfectly consistent to them. They do say that they like to look back on this because sitting down and doing it so quickly means that to them, the art looks really consistent. Oh, yeah. And I think that they sometimes obsess over it. I'd say that we have learned that they maybe obsess over their own consistency, that means a lot to them. And it's interesting because I think there's only so much an artist can actually control that. And I'm not sure it's even that necessary. But if it's a value as an artist that you have, then it's necessary to you, right?
Yeah. It's also interesting because of the things we've read so far, the only thing that I really feel like you see a shift within the series is Rig Veda.
And that's because it took them 7 years.
It is,
you're going to be a different artist
and
7 years later.
And 7 important years in which they went from being, like, amateurs to producing multiple series at once. Like, not just 7 years in their long career, but 7 years in the very beginning. But everything else has been done a little so far that we've looked at have been done faster and feels more consistent.
Yes.
So it's interesting to see them, you know, already kind of feeling like they're losing consistency by spending more time on projects.
Yeah. Anyway, I feel like I learned here why ink wash isn't in vogue for comics printing.
And, that's just dark, like black ink watered down to get different gradients, correct?
Yes. Yes. Sometimes you wet the page first to lay that down in order to get it to, like, bloom across the water, which is really great. It gives you a really specific look. They did a lot of cool things here. They also used a technique, I'm almost certain they used this technique because they use it in so much of their other artwork, and I learned it from them, to flick either...
paint. I know that's a technique.
Yeah, either white paint or corrective fluid, white out, right?
Yeah.
Which, honestly, we used white out all the time because white out will sit on top of colored pencil and Copic and anything.
Yeah, I remember there was a phase in high school in art class where we were just flicking everything with white paint
everywhere,
just to get that, like crazy, sparkle thing happening.
Like, crazy. But they use it really well in this to get the effect of the snowflakes a lot of the time. And it looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's so good.
So I think that that's everything I really wanted to say about the production process for this. I mean, this comic, I don't know that it even ran in that magazine. I can't quite figure out, like, I can't quite interpret, like, we have information like, oh, it ran in this and this and this, and none of that to me adds up to it ran in this magazine.
I mean...
It was collected by the same... The same publisher definitely did run it, though.
Okay. Like, I wasn't sure if it actually went in a magazine or if it just went straight to print.
Yeah, I can't quite... I am bad at interpreting which of those things we're seeing here, but it definitely got put together into a nice, like, a nice little collection. They said something about it having embossing on the cover, and they wanted to have embossing and gold, and they were told that the gold was going to flake off if you had embossing, and they were like, we want it that way, just so they could get it to happen. And we've mentioned before that, like, the volumes we have in English, which, you know, came out almost 10 years later, oh, maybe more than 10 years later.
About exactly. The hardback Tokyopop put out in 2003 here, so yeah. If the original was 2002, it may have been about 10 years since the volume had come out.
Yeah.
And then there was a paperback released in 2004, with the same format. So if you're looking to buy it, I don't know if there are very different prices for those two, but that means you have more options.
Yeah.
There was at least two printings.
Which is nice.
And then in 2015, Viz did re-release it, but only digitally.
Yeah.
So, which I... is a bummer, because it's so beautiful as a physical art form to hold, because it was done in all that ink and everything, so I'm hoping maybe someone will reproduce it.
But I haven't looked at that version, and I will say that, not to say anything mean about the people who worked hard to make the physical book come out, but the reproduction is not incredibly high quality.
Hmm.
Like, it isn't maybe as crisp as it could be, and don't know whether that's because the source files are, you know, limited. Like, whether they're having to basically use scans of a book instead of the original artwork, which is often what happens for stuff like this. But it could be even more beautiful, Lucy. That is my complaint.
It could be even more beautiful. We can actually look at it.
Yeah, we could.
I have a preview of the digital version of it. So if anyone has the Viz app, you can see a preview of it. You can't purchase it. Oh, is that all we get?
Yeah, I can't tell from the cover.
Okay, so you can see a preview of the cover, which doesn't really help us. Oh, wait, no, there's more. Let me see. That's the colored part. Because, like a lot of manga, this has the first few pages are in color, which you see a lot in Japan and not as often here. But Tokyopop was big in doing that in their releases that were coming out in the 2000s.
Yeah, color printing is even more expensive here than it is elsewhere, and it's expensive everywhere. Hence why manga is not in color. Yeah, I think this might look a little bit crisper, but I also think it is just darker, and some of that darker doesn't play well with their ink wash. So I don't know. I don't know what the definitive version of this is.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. But it doesn't really matter, because it is so nicely done that even a slight, like, print quality messiness, like, does not ruin it.
Yeah.
We have a few words to say about themes, and then I want to talk about Yuki Onna a little bit, because I just like ghosts, and this isn't a ghost story, and I feel like I promised a ghost story to everybody, and it just isn't, but I'm going to get a ghost story, I'm going to get some ghosts into this podcast this week, because I guess. I would say that this does feel like it's done in 10 days, in the nicest way possible.
Mm.
Like, this is an genius way to do something beautiful and worthy in 10 days, but the story's like, there's not a ton of world building, they're so elegant, they're so atmospheric, but there's not a whole lot else to them. Each one of them is absolutely worth reading, and they're stories that, like, you might even think about as you're walking through a snowy forest the next time you do that. Like, I don't think there's any, in no way do I want to diminish this work, but
they're very evocative, but
but it definitely has that, like, oh yeah, I can kind of understand that this is a thing you could make in 10 days. The work, like, the artwork is beautiful, it is flowy, it is loose, it is so cool to see them working in a way that is so different from how they normally work. But it definitely, again, it was carefully constructed to be something they could do quickly. And there are panels where I'm almost proud of them for how messy they let the panels be. There are a few panels where there's trees where I'm like, that's not the optimal way to have done that. And the tree doesn't make you want to just look at that tree forever, and it doesn't matter. And I want to just say a few words about comics. If every panel is super meticulous, it's hard, and really detailed, it's hard for your eye to know where to go on a page. Because you're not being directed, you're being told to stare at every panel. And when you do that, you're losing some of the flow of storytelling. And also, it can be very much, it can be distracting.
We had a little bit of a problem with this with Chang Huang, which we didn't touch on too much, I don't think, where sometimes it was so detailed that you couldn't tell which panel was supposed to come first or what exactly was going on.
Yeah, you can. That one really felt like it was early in their work. Very early Rig Veda also had a little bit of like, ooh, these layouts are so full of stuff that I'm not sure where my eye is supposed to go. And that is a part of the art form of comic storytelling that is very invisible, because you shouldn't notice it at all. And it means that there are a lot of people who, when they talk about comics, they tell you whether they think the art is good. And their idea of good comic art may be really consistent proportions, it might be really specific inking style, it might be high detail, it might be that they personally find it beautiful, but they are probably leaving out the part where, is it readable? Can you tell what's happening in every panel? Do you know where your eye is supposed to go on the page? Are you focusing where you're supposed to focus? Or are you getting tripped up and distracted by every little thing in every panel? And there are legitimate projects like that do that to you on purpose. Like, places where you're supposed to kind of stumble through this really intricate world, sometimes that's purposeful and that's fine, but for a lot of comic artists, it becomes an obsession, and it becomes a way they think that they are, like, earning their right to be looked at, right? Well, like, well, I have to work this hard. Every panel needs to be perfect and meticulous, or else I'm not good enough. And that's absurd. It is actually absurd, I think, for people to be really stuck on that when there are panels that exist to move you across the page. And especially with manga, where they do a lot of interstitial panels that are beats that help you know how much time has passed, or that are like where you're literally looking at the sky between two panels of dialogue, those are not lazy. Those are not accidental. Those are not filler. That is how they are telling the story. And I think that that can get lost, especially when we don't have a whole lot of language for discussing how comics work. And I know I bring this up a lot, but I think that this comic is so good at that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't have as much language, I guess, and skill to notice it, but yeah, it really just made it flow so fast.
Yeah, and it's part of what you mean when you say atmospheric. Mm. That's part of what contributes to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we're talking about these themes, and there's some kind of revenge, right?
Yeah, that... I mean, and that really reminded me of Cheng Huang, too, because we had the whole, like, her story begins because she avenges her mother's death, and then goes on to, you know, kind of further avenge wrongdoing, I guess. And the Wolf Mountain story really reminded me of that, because, you know, the death happens off screen of her father, and she's just going on this revenge mission, really. And it is kind of one of those, like, learn to love your captor type things, but it just felt
He's not her captor, though.
Yeah.
So it definitely, but it does have this sort of, like, trying to understand where the villainy is here. Like, was there actually an injustice done or not, especially when you're talking about nature?
The whole idea of having revenge against a wolf for killing a human when that may have just, we don't know the circumstances, it may have been something, you know, that wolf may have been starving and this was the first meat it'd seen in a while. Like, we don't know. It's not quite like when a human kills another human and there's usually like a, some sort of inciting incident or maliciousness.
Yeah, like this is literally an animal needs to eat or is protecting its cubs or whatever it is. Like, again, I was saying, like, we anthropomorphize animals and then you can think you're going to take revenge against something that didn't mean to hurt you. It's just, it had to do what it had to do to survive. And of course, this story does question that and is like, is that what's going on? Or is there all of this very human intention for this beast? And that comes up again with the herons, right? Who maybe aren't animals at all, maybe are only spiritual. A lot of folklore, especially Japanese folklore, but all of folklore, will do some interesting things with, like, really anthropomorphizing animals, but also preserving some true things about how animals do behave and ascribing human motivations to those, and that ends blurring the lines between humans and other animals. I mean, we're animals too, right? But by blurring those lines more, it can help you understand your own nature as an animal and also help to understand that there really isn't as much of a border between those as you maybe want to think that there is. And I think that story does a great job of that. They're also very spiritual. Like, those creatures may never have been flesh and blood. Or did we get Shirahime's origin story as a heron spirit, right? We don't know which one is going on there. Again, in a very folklore mythological way where, like, even in this, it feels like you're getting disputed stories by different folklorists, right? Like, it even feels like you're getting regional differences between the same folklore. Like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I love it. And that one especially really reminded me of, like, the types of stories where a god will take a mortal form in which they can actually be killed to achieve some end, or because it has to happen once a year or something.
Yeah.
And so it very much felt like even more of a sacrifice if these were gods that of some form that were getting killed.
Yeah, they were giving something up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And Ice Flower, I really like it. It doesn't quite have the revenge side or the kind of nature thing. It feels more like And there's so little of it, but it really feels like this girl gave up everything, like, just because she knew she was being left alone, and she wasn't really protesting. I think that's one where he's like, why won't you ask me to stay? And she's kind of says something along the lines of, I know it wouldn't do any good, so I'm not going to, I know you have to go. And it's just such a interesting sacrifice that she gave up her entire future just to wait for him, yeah, in a way that he couldn't even come back to, really. Yeah, you know?
She almost becomes a piece of nature in order to not have to deal with the human tragedy that's, yeah, going on, which is interesting, too.
Yeah.
And in all of these stories, you know, again, the last line for Shirahime is that, like, oh, these are not my tears, these are your tears. These are the tears of human misery and human sacrifice and everything. I'm like, yeah, no, it's interesting to that whole theme of how much are we anthropomorphizing, the idea that are we anthropomorphizing the snow as calling it this goddess's tears, mm-hmm, or are we missing that on some level we have taken on the snow, like the isolation, the bitterness, the cold that separates you from the parts of the year that where everything is green and growing, like all of this, the sort of the death, right, mm-hmm, the death aspect of winter. Are we reconnecting with it through the idea that these snowflakes are our tears? Did we earn this terrible winter through our own hardship, through our own cruelty, through our own tragedy and our own ability to make tragedy? Is nature hurting humans, or do humans deserve this, right?
Yeah, that very much has the whole, like, you create your own misery type.
Yeah.
You create your own destruction, because in all of them, the snow is a danger, right? Like, it's, you know, it's why Fubuki gets stuck out in the storm, is because it's very snowy, and the dogs attack her, but, like, it's a danger in all of them that they are facing. Like, it's, you know, the reason that the girl is frozen in the lake is because it's so cold and snowy that can happen, and, you know, and it's a great hardship for her soldier to come back, or her guy, to come back because of the snow. And in the third one, like, he's literally trapped in the snow and getting buried by it. And so in all of them, like, I guess it's interesting to take that, see that as a threat to all of them, and then have it be revealed that that is, like, humanity that is kind of crushing them.
Yeah, it wasn't the winter, it was the war.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that is, I think that, again, they did this in 10 days. That's a lot of stuff to get in there.
Yeah, definitely.
And some of it helps that there are some, like, folkloristic, like, connections to this material, that, like, there is a lot to be said about snow and its significance to Japanese culture, to all of humans, but to Japanese culture. Which brings me to my last thematic question that is really just an excuse for me to talk about ghosts.
I'm not complaining.
Which, you know, I had a thematic question of, is she a Yuki-onna? Mm. And Clamp say that she isn't specifically a Yuki-onna, but they have to say this because she so clearly she so clearly is one that they need to differentiate her from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fair, because, again, she's actually an observer, and these themes we just stated, right? She's, mm-hmm, she is not causing any of this misery. She is not the fulcrum on which this folkloristic thing is turning. She's not at all. She's just an observer. She just offers some commentary. But Yuki-onna stories are really important, they're really ancient, and they're different depending on where they come from. They're not always called a Yuki-onna either.
Yeah, there are a ton. Like, I was researching this a bit too, and there are just a lot of names. A lot of them have Yuki in them, but not all of them. Some of them kind of reference, like, icicles. Yeah, and other snowy-like things.
Yes. And they are way across the spectrum of scary to benevolent. Sometimes there's scary sex vampires who freeze you to death. Sometimes they're sad ghosts. Sometimes she's from the moon. But they are really interestingly ancient and omnipresent.
Oh, and Yuki-onna literally just means snow woman.
Yes.
We should probably mention that. Yes. Yuki is snow, so it, yeah, comes up a lot.
And they're very nebulously, like, are they ghosts? Are they monsters, like yokai?
Mm-hmm.
Are they gods? Are they kami? And of course, the difference between those things does get foggy and nebulous. Think about Inari, who is a goddess, but Kitsune are foxes,
mm-hmm,
and she is so associated with them that sometimes that overlaps completely. And in animistic religions, the difference between some of those things is very semantic and maybe has more to do with how people outside that culture don't understand the subtle differences, or whether those differences are just aspects of the same creature, or whether they're just clumsy language doing a bad job of describing something that is way more complex. But one of the most famous Yuki-onna stories worldwide is the one from Lafcadio Hearn's writings. And Lafcadio Hearn is a wild personality who's interesting to look up, but was one of the first Westerners who wrote about Japanese folklore, Japanese culture, Japanese anything, because he lived there in the late 1800s, early 1900s, before he died fairly young. But he died in Japan as a naturalized citizen with a wife and children who were Japanese. He had been a professor at Waseda University. He was hugely influential on the West because he brought all these stories over. And he is obviously, there's a lot of complicated feelings about him because the way he writes about it is a little exotic. I mean, like, it is exoticized. It's not always 100% like the way that anyone should talk about anyone else's culture. And also very stuck in his perspective, but also sometimes wildly excited and respectful because he was really impressed with so much of what he encountered. But his books are some of, like, the books that still get referenced for Japanese folklore and mythology because they've been around for so long, they're just there. I'm going to extremely paraphrase his Oyuki. And Oyuki is a woman's name. In that period, in a lot of the history of Japan, putting all in front of a name was a feminizing thing for women's names.
Interesting.
I also think the story is significant because it has a pretty boy in it, and is part of the whole, like, the word bishonen has perhaps existed for longer than the idea of a bishoujo, and it's interesting how much it is, like, important to the story. So, here is my extremely paraphrased version of Oyuki. An old woodcutter and a young woodcutter were caught in a snowstorm. Luckily, they found a hut to spend the night in, but in the middle of the night, the young woodcutter woke up to see a beautiful lady in white. She breathed on the old man, and he died. But instead of breathing on the young man, she stopped. I was going to kill you, but you are too young and beautiful. Do not tell anyone about this night, or I will have to kill you. He keeps his mouth shut, but a few days later, he meets a beautiful woman named Oyuki, and they hit it off and got married. They lived happily together for a long time with lots of children, but it always bothered him that she reminded him so much of the woman who killed the old woodcutter that one night. Also, she stayed young and beautiful, unaging. Finally, he couldn't ignore this any longer, and he told her about that night. I do not know if it was a dream or if I really saw Yuki Onna. She jumps up and says, yes, it was I, and you were told never to speak of it. I cannot kill you for the sake of our children, but now you must take care of them. And she melted away like snow.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, nice and eerie, nice and weird. She definitely saw something she liked and decided to not kill this. I have, like, the age of him is different depending on who tells the story and what's going on there. But, I mean, he was old enough to have kids by the time they got married, so whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know, it's ancient times, baby.
Yeah.
God.
Everyone died when they were, like, 30, so...
Yeah.
It's interesting, the ending, because from the little research I did, it seemed like there was a common theme of them kind of melting away as snow hitting water, you know?
Yeah, right? Well, and of course, this story, this particular story, is also not very different from the Selkie story, the mermaid story, the crane wife story. Mm-hmm. I think there's a turtle version from China. Like, this is an age-old, the fairy wife in Ireland, the story of, like, the wife who is not quite human and who gives you specific rules, and when you break them, everything falls apart. And I do not have a degree in folkloristics, unfortunately, even though I always wanted to do that. So that's my, if I ever go back to school, which that'll never happen, I'm way too poor for that.
Never know, it could be a thing you do when you retire.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm gonna roll in some degrees now.
Yeah, that sounds great. But I'm obsessed with folklore, and I think it's interesting. I also would say that, like, they took pains to differentiate Shirahime from characters like this purposefully, right?
Mm-hmm.
That a character like that would be the villain or not the villain, but the antagonist or the object of a story. And
yeah,
in this case,
it has, like, an active part.
Yeah.
Shirahime, in this anyway, was just kind of an observer.
Yeah. And again, their theme led to that. Their theme was, the winter is not your enemy, you are your enemy, right? Like, human misery causes human misery. It's not just about snowflakes. It's not just it's not just nature gods messing with you.
Mm-hmm.
You make it worse for yourselves. And I think that's a really interesting take for any stories about that could be about spirits and monsters, because so often we want to use them as a scapegoat for the worst things about humans and to take responsibility for what you do, as opposed to ascribing it to a supernatural force. It's a really interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
And an interesting thing to think about in terms of clamp works.
Yes.
So I think that's something to chew on a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So, I think that's most of the legend stuff. I just wanted to touch on the title quickly, because I have a bit of a pet peeve about it.
I think you're ridiculous for this pet peeve.
It's really bothering me. I don't know why that... So, the title is Shirahime Sho, which translates just basically to snow goddess tales. So it's a pretty direct translation. But for some reason, they've written Seol as S-Y-O. Seol?
Yeah, that is a little wild.
Yeah, I just don't know why.
That may be to give it a more historical tone, because that used to be how you would romanize that.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. My stupid Japanese classes did that, and you're right, that's a different romanization style. It's just weird that they would combine them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming...
Because in that...
Hey, if you're really going to transliterate it, it is White Princess Collection.
Well, yeah, but if you were using that...
Totally not.
But if you were using that romanization style, Shirahime would be written S-I-R-A.
I'm still saying I think it was just intended to give it a historical feel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I will accept that. But anyway, I think it's interesting that you say Seol, not Seol.
Yeah.
So everyone knows.
And the original calligraphy for the Japanese title was done by Makona.
Yeah.
And she said that she did not nail it on the first try. So, of course, this is pre-Photoshop. They couldn't just adjust something's tilt a little bit by selecting it and free transforming it. They actually had to like make copies and nudge it over that way. And oh my god, I am not that good at keeping craft clean, so I'm not great for doing this by hand. So I'm so impressed that they managed to do that. It's just great.
Yeah, I was very focused on the calligraphy of the title, because before I decided to look it up online, my roommate and I were trying to look them up in a kanji dictionary. And we were really having trouble figuring out what the Seol kanji was, especially since it was written... Like, I was trying to figure out if it was something strange, which is why it was S-Y-O instead of just Seol. But yeah, no, I just had to look it up online, and then it gave me the direct translation. I felt silly, but yeah. I went through this journey, now you have.
All right, so speaking of our journey, we are going to start January with a bit of a behind-the-scenes episode. If you have any questions, please hit them to us on Twitter, an email. Let us know if there's anything you want us to address, and we'll be happy to do that in that episode. But we're also just going to kind of tell you where we are in the Clamp timeline, how many things we're currently running, what was going on. So we'll set the scene.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about the year to come and what we're going to look at and how we're going to handle X. And like Robin said, answer any questions you have either about like how we do this or, I don't know, anything about our favorites that we haven't mentioned yet, or if you, really anything. This is a good chance to just have questions that you'd like to ask us. I'm going to make a Twitter thread about it, I guess, that you can respond to, but, or you can just email us through our website.
Yeah, that will be us getting ready to kick off our series for X. If you're reading along, it's a good time to get your hands on the first few volumes. Our first episode, which will be the second episode...
Of January, yeah.
Yes. Our first X episode, which will be the second episode we put out in January, will really just cover the first volume, and then I will go on for a long time about Japanese new religions, the occult boom, and millennial apocalyptic dread in the 90s, because I really think that X is such a product of its time that if we don't talk about the context a lot, it is not going to make sense or be as interesting.
Yeah, we are going to have a lot to say about X, so I'm pretty excited to get going on that. I know, if you're interested in reading along and you don't currently have X, Viz released it in little 3-volume omnibus chunks, and I'm going to be trying to track those down because I don't own the beginning of it anymore, or at least I can't find my early volumes.
Ta-da!
So that hopefully Robin and I should have different versions that we're working off of, which should lead to some interesting like translation notes and stuff too. So in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at ClampCastPod, on Facebook at ClampCast in Wonderland, and you can check out our website, ClampCastInWonderland.com, where we've got the recipes and other fun stuff.
Thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember, everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.